Hi, it's Lisa Z from Real Crime Profile. Today we have part three of our coverage of the Reeva Steenkamp murder by Oscar Pistorius, including our reactions to his July 6th sentencing. So just to let you know, because Jim and Laura are on location doing another project in a different time zone and with very dodgy internet access, we had to record this over a cell phone call. So the sound is not as clear as we would like it to be, but we only had a very brief window of time that we could record the pod at all, so I'm glad we got it done. Anyway, thanks for listening, and as always, let us know your thoughts.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richard. For those who don't know, I'm formerly Scotland Yard and trained with the FBI, and I'm a criminal behavioural analyst and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And with me is
Lisa Zambetti, and I am the Customer Director for Criminal Minds and Beyond Borders, and our colleague Jim Clementi is not with us today. Both he and Laura are in an undisclosed location working very hard on another project, so I'm very happy that we could make time to do this pod right now. So this is going to be our third podcast on the Reeva Steenkamp murder by her boyfriend, Oscar Pistorius. So in part one of our series, if you guys missed it, Jim and Laura read through back and forth texts between Reeva and her boyfriend, Oscar. These were also the texts that were read in court. And as Jim and Laura pointed out, there was very controlling behavior, very childish, selfish behavior by Oscar in these texts, and it also showed her attempts to de-escalate his anger and reason with him, but it certainly showed that he was very angry, very jealous kind of person. Laura, after that first podcast, the listener pointed out that there were actually many, many more texts read in court, and I guess apparently it made the judge think on the whole that the text, on the whole didn't seem that bad, and that was sort of like an isolated bit of arguing that they did. Do you buy that argument?
I think we have to think about the fact that these are WhatsApp messages, and you always have to put things in a context. And I also listened and heard all the other evidence that was given around the WhatsApp messages, and I actually still think that those particular messages are incredibly relevant. They do point to coercive control. Many people do not identify it. They don't understand that dynamic and the rules that are laid down that victims try and adhere to. And the other thing that I have to say is that there was also lots of other evidence that Judge Masipa seemed to disregard. And she basically heard witnesses who said that they heard people fighting and Steenkamp's blood-curdling screams, or a female's blood-curdling screams. And the person who gave that ear witness testimony said very clearly that it was not a male, as Pistorius would have us believe. And Masipa chose to disregard, the neighbours who gave numerous ear witness testimony, as well as previous partners who also talked about abuse they suffered at the hands of Pistorius. And one particular previous partner was someone called Samantha Taylor. And for me, her evidence was compelling and clear. Given what Samantha Taylor said, which were things like he was incredibly insecure, he was very angry and had control issues, and he was like a Jekyll and Hyde, that his personality would shift and shift pretty rapidly. And she never knew what kind of mood he would be in. And he would call her parents at least 10 times a day to find out where she was. And in any one month, he would call her over 700 times.
Oh, my God.
This is, clear and compelling evidence to me that it's not just a one-off set of behaviours. This is somebody who was entitled. This is somebody who wanted to get his own way. He would turn up at Samantha Taylor's house or apartment at 5 a.m. in the morning, having been out boozing, and would be incredibly jealous and would question her about having affairs, would make her take pictures of herself at home to prove that she was sat at home in her pajamas. These are all coercive, controlling behaviours. And He would get angry if he didn't get his way, if his copy wasn't right. You know, the same kind of things that we heard from Reva, in that if she didn't do things a certain way, the way she chewed her chewing gum, the way she said things, the way that she behaved, he was constantly undermining her. And these are the sorts of things that tell us about coercive control. And Samantha also told us about the fact that he was a good liar. And, you know, he lied in court. So the judge disregarded her evidence. That was her decision, saying that she was a woman scorned. Well, actually, we always take into account previous behaviours and previous partners, because that tells us and gives us insight to what's going on now. So I think you always have to take things in context. And, you know, Judge Masipa also said that she found Pistorius to be a poor and contradictory witness. So I think it's really bizarre that she said this was not about gender violence, because certainly to me it sounded very much that's what it was about, and that he was argumentative, he was self-indulgent, rude and jealous and tantrumous, and he was controlling, and he believed that women were possessions. And she may believe that he's incapable of being abusive, but that doesn't mean to say that the rest of us should also believe that. And she might, again, believe that his whimpering and the way that he behaved was genuine and a mitigating factor for a light sentence, but I certainly do not. I believe that he was acting and he played a part, and that's, even with the ITV interview, you know, the timing of that, for me, is unconscionable. And, you know, I'm wholly horrified that ITV chose to air that just days before his sentencing, because I think that had a very significant impact on the outcome.
Yeah, I didn't see that particular interview, but so he was able to make his case before his sentencing outside of court.
Well, listen, here's the deal for me. I mean, there was a sentencing hearing. He should have given evidence at that, and yet his psychiatrist and others said that he was a broken man, and therefore, you know, he was clinically depressed and he was incapable of giving evidence. And yet, you know, here we see him taking to the world platform in a documentary by ITV with Mark William Thomas asking the questions. And it's in direct contrast to the fact that he's saying, you know, he's broken and he's not able to give evidence in the official court setting. That, for me, is a major problem. You know, he created a spectacle at sentencing by taking off his prosthetic legs and using his vulnerability at a time when he chooses to. And it's a double standard that he creates. And he was given a platform. So where else do we see a convicted murderer being given a platform, his own TV show, just before sentencing?
Yeah, it also just reminds me of what OJ did in his, and we've talked about that extensively, how he, you know, doesn't want to get on the stand, but he took the opportunity to make a statement, you know. So
absolutely. Well, he tried to make a statement, even though he wasn't prepared to be questioned. You know, by giving evidence. And, you know, the OJ and Pistorius parallels for me are ironically significant. You know, both entitled individuals, both said that they didn't do it, both hired best defense teams they could, both treated women like possessions, both felt they could break the rules and make the rules. And, you know, I think for me, the fact that Reva had no voice and still has no voice, and, you know, Pistorius uses the ITV interview to say things like, you know, he doesn't want to go back to prison. Well, I dare say most people don't want to go to prison, and that, you know, he wants to help people less fortunate than himself, and that Reva would have wanted this and would not have wanted him to go to prison. I mean, that tells you everything about his narcissism, and that makes me incredibly angry, because Reva doesn't have a voice, nor do those allegedly less fortunate people. And, you know, Jerry Nell said that it was incredibly disrespectful for Pistorius to do that ITV interview. And I think it, for me, it's outrageous and disrespectful.
Yeah. If we, just to also recap, so in the part two of our podcast series, you and Jim had discussed the crime scene and the version of events that Mr. Pistorius gave to police, and the contradictions later found in his statements, found in the evidence, et cetera. We went through some of that. I took a look at some of the crime scene photos, Laura. I had not until yesterday. And they're out there on the internet, not just the bloody trail around the house, but pictures of Reva just right after the incident, you know, close-up photos of her face. You've probably seen those photos too, right?
I've seen some of the photographs, yes.
What I noticed is they're very hard to look at, but I noticed that it looks like she has a black eye. I don't know if you remember that. And that some of the forensic evidence suggested that she had been hit on the – she's got marks on her back that look like she was hit. And, you know, some people say that, you know, that's proof that he was chasing her around the house, you know, probably hit her with the bat, maybe gave her a black eye, and that's why she was hiding in the toilet. Do you feel that that rings true to you?
Well, I think we have to be very careful here of sort of the armchair detective of looking at photographs that aren't of a particularly good quality. And, you know, when the police investigation was done, it was extraordinarily bad. And many aspects of the evidence was not explained. And I think just like the OJ case, they thought it was a pretty open and shut case that of who did it, and therefore it would be relatively straightforward. And so certain things probably weren't done to the standard that they should be. So I think it's a very difficult thing to say. You know, I'm fully aware of the book that was published by Calvin and Thomas Mullett, or Mollett, I think it was, Oscar versus the Truth. And, you know, they make certain interpretations, and I'm sure they're very well intentioned about what went on. But I don't think how they've gone about it is the right way to do forensics. And for me, certainly, you know, there are things that are unexplained, but it's very hard to say. And certainly the quality of those photographs are particularly bad. So I have no doubt that there was an argument that was going on beforehand because of what the ear witnesses say, that there was people arguing, and there was a blood-curdling scream from a female. And, you know, the gun was discharged once, and then it was discharged three times, and the scream was in between, which basically means that Castorius no doubt knew that it was Reva that was in the bathroom, the toilet cubicle.
Right.
So I think because they didn't do a proper forensic investigation, you know, it's very difficult to say what those marks were on her. But one thing's for sure, you know, she screamed, she locked herself in that toilet cubicle. She had her phone with her. She was fleeing. And, you know, her parents also said that she was packing her suitcase or her bag, and she was going to leave. So, you know, with separation and finality and rejection and coercive control, this is a very, and an entitled individual, this is a very dangerous combination.
Yes, indeed. I haven't read the book that you mentioned, so, and I am armchair detectiving it just when I was just looking at those pictures, and they're just heartbreaking, you know. So now that here we are at part three.
I mean, the other thing, just to say, Lisa, is that, you know, someone like Dr. Henry Lee would be the ideal person to forensically review that case. And anything forensically, you have to do hands-on. You can't do it from a distance, and that's what the problem is with the two brothers. And I haven't actually read the book. I've certainly read everything that's been published in the media, and they basically say that Reva had a wound on her back which matches the tip of the cricket bat, and therefore they claim she was hit with it before, and that he may have also fired, you know, discharged his firearm at her beforehand, before she locked herself in the bathroom, because there's apparently a wound on her arm. So, you know, they've matched it up by looking at crime scene photos. That certainly they're not forensic scientists either. And I think, you know, I think one of them's an engineer, the other one, the other brother, I'm not sure what he does. So I know that there was a lot of publicity about the launch of their book, but it certainly doesn't lend itself to sort of the standard of the Dr. Henry Lee type, you know, experiments or forensic analysis. You know, he's a criminalist with many, many decades of reviewing. He was a previous former police officer and then forensic scientist. So, you know, I would be very confident if it was someone like Dr. Henry Lee looking at it, but less so those who you know, are looking at crime scene photos with no real expertise in that area. So I think we have to be very careful about the things that have been in the media subsequently, because the evidence was heard and tested at court. And I have to say, I don't agree with Judge Masipa's analysis and certainly her decision vis-a-vis the culpable homicide and the original five-year sentence. And I think, you know, the sentence that when the charge was then upgraded to murder, and that was because 15 judges at the Supreme Court ruled that that should be the case, I think it was always going to be a situation where she would, you know, be very kind of moderate, really, in terms of her response and sentencing, because otherwise it would go against the things that she had said previously when she had sentenced him to 5 years.
Laura, hold that thought. I want to get back. I have a bunch of other questions for you, but right now let's hear a word about our sponsor. So we're back, and so Laura, what was your reaction, I think it was last Wednesday, when the verdict, the resentencing came down?
Well, you know, I was pretty aghast that he only got 6 years, given that the minimum sentence is 15 years. But then when you balance it against the fact that Judge Masipa gave 5 years for culpable homicide, which in the UK is the equivalent of manslaughter, I didn't ever think she was really going to give any more, because it would make her look foolish in her original decision. So I think one of the problems was, you know, the premeditated murder charge should never have really been premeditated murder. I think that was, you know, a big problem that the state went for that. But I certainly think that she came down moderately, because otherwise, you know, it would fly in the face of what she had ruled before.
So you don't think, do you think it was wrong for them to go after premeditated because you don't think it was premeditated, or it just wasn't something that they could win with?
I genuinely felt it was just, there were two things really. One is that, you know, premeditated murder, you have to show that the intention was there and, you know, that there was pre-planning and premeditation. And that's a difficult thing to prove, and therefore it was, you know, a big undertaking for the state to try and prove that, particularly with a, you know, a bad and compromised police investigation. And the other part is that, you know, it was a situation that unfolded and he impulsively reacted, and he reacted and shot her dead, and he didn't just discharge the firearm once, it was four times with a scream between the first and the next three rounds being fired off. So I think that was always a problem. And then certainly, you know, the same judge, that part is, you know, a big question mark for me, the same judge being asked to make a ruling on the murder charge meant that she was always going to be fairly conservative. And I felt that we were never going to get the 15-year sentence, and that it was going to be precedential, really, in her decision. And therefore, Pistorius, and I think his defence team, knew that they had to really go hard and fast around a campaign, really, to show that, you know, he was somebody who had shown remorse, who was, you know, broken by his actions, who wanted to do community work, and, you know, prison wasn't the right or suitable punishment for him. And that's exactly what they set about doing.
What do you think, what would have happened if, instead of this whole story of the intruder and this and that, if he had just said, yes, I had a moment of insanity and it escalated and this happened? I mean, what do you think about that, if he had come clean, so to speak?
Well, the first thing is that this isn't about a moment of insanity. This is about control. And so it's a very different thing. You know, there's no mental health issues here. And yes, he may be clinically depressed now. I dare say he is, given that, you know, as Judge Masipa mentioned in her sentencing, that, you know, he is a broken man, he's a fallen hero, who has lost his career, he's been ruined financially, he cannot be at peace, you know, all this whole poor me piece. The way that he behaved in his relationships with other women tells us that. So, yes, if he had said, you know, this is what happened, which I know, you know, certainly many narcissists are incapable of saying exactly what happened and putting somebody else at the centre of it and saying that they got it wrong. So I would never expect that from someone like Pistorius. He's the one that will continue to play the victim in all of this. But it would have been a very different trial, and they would have been looking at the 15-year minimum, and he and his defence team would well have known that. So he had to argue it from the point of view that it was the intruder theory, much like we've seen in other cases, actually. But there were certainly no signs of a forced entry. There were some serious and glaring inconsistencies in Pistorius's illogical account of what happened. And I think, you know, Botha and others believe that it was murder right from the start, but it was always going to be a difficult case because the crime scene was compromised, because the police didn't do a good investigation. Very similar to the O.J. Simpson case. And because he was a celebrity and, you know, a hero of sorts, and it was always going to be a challenge. And I think certainly in South Africa, where we're talking about, you know, a woman is killed every 8 hours by her partner or ex-partner, the context of it means that Judge Masipa may think that because with Reva there were signs of coercive control, because there wasn't anything physical going on, that's just the normal state of play over there. But that certainly doesn't make it right. So she was ruling in the context of all the things that they hear about in South Africa. And for me, that doesn't make abuse right, because it is rife.
You know, on the day of the sentencing, I was doing a casting session, and this actor came in and did an audition for me, and I heard a slight something in his accent. He was supposed to be playing an American, but I heard something, and I was like, are you from South Africa? And he said, yes, you know, they have that's a very distinct sound, as I'm sure you know. And I said, so what do you think about the hearing today? And he just looked at me. His face got beet red. His eyes filled with tears, and he's like, I knew Reva. We worked together in South Africa, and he just, you know, he was really upset about the ruling, and I was shocked. You know, it's just, it's a small world. It's a smaller world than you think it is, and to have somebody in front of me who actually really knew her and loved her, that was very upsetting, you know.
That's amazing. And what did he say about it? I mean, what was the general sense from, you know, his family and friends at home?
No, he thought that he was 100% guilty, that he was, this was something that had was due to happen just because of, I mean, look, he had covered, you know, Oscar had covered up a previous gun incident and had another friend take a fall for it. So, you know, I mean, that's
right.
The world that they're running in. So, I mean, it wasn't, I didn't have a long conversation with this actor, but it was just like kind of one of these moments of like, oh my gosh, this is a real person, you know, who is not just a woman, a face in a magazine or, you know, on the television. For me, it was just like a headline, you know, something to be outraged about, something to get on our Facebook page and talk about, but it wasn't real until he looked at me in the eye, you know, and that barrier between actor and casting director kind of, you know, went down for a moment, and we were just looking at each other like real people, and I was like, wow, you know, gut check time, you know?
Yeah,
anyway.
And you get that sense from her, you know, from her family, and, you know, certainly from her friends. I know some people who, you know, live very close to where his parents live, and, you know, the general sense of people that I've picked up from, you know, in terms of what they thought went on, is that his account is so fanciful and has so many inconsistencies in it, and it's illogical that it just does not make sense. And that means that something else went on, and there's an alternative version of what happened. And,
yeah.
You know, I think, you know, Judge Masipa made a decision. Of course, their criminal justice system is very different in that it's one judge that hears the evidence. But certainly, you know, the things that I heard, you know, I felt that at times maybe we're at different trials because she disregarded things that I felt were very significant, and his former relationships and the way that he behaved, because it wasn't just Samantha Taylor, it was another woman that he was arrested for assaulting, actually by Detective Hilton Botha.
Right, I had read that too.
Do you remember? Yeah, and his previous girlfriend's friend at a party, they'd had an argument and he had kicked out his girlfriend from the party, and the friend went with her but had left her keys in the house. So she went back and Pistorius just smashed the door against her leg, and she ended up being hospitalized. And apparently Pistorius was arrested and he's taken down the station, and all the police, you know, are trying to get his autograph.
Yeah, and who does that remind us of?
Exactly. O.J. Simpson and that kind of entitlement. So the parallels, I really think, are there, you know, and that entitlement and the celebrity and the wealth aspect and them being legends and, you know, people who don't abide by the rules, you know, really did weigh in there.
Yeah. One last thing I want to ask you about. Did you ever see that reenactment that he did? That where he used his sister and kind of he filmed like a reenactment of the whole thing. And did you ever see any of that footage?
I didn't know what Pistorius filmed.
Yes, really bizarre. Where he goes into the bathroom and his sister acts as Reva and he reenacts like picking her up and carrying her. And so he gets to sort of again, you know, control the narrative. I mean, what other person do you know would could have that kind of a platform where he could, you know, show the story that he wanted to show and it gets broadcast?
Yeah, I mean, it's just unconscionable. And, you know, I do think just giving them a world platform, and certainly, you know, where are the other convicted murderers who are given a TV program right at the critical time? And certainly, you know, I was watching the Twitter feeds and his brother, Carl Pistorius, put out this picture of him that just made me incredibly angry of, after court, him lying on the sofa with, you know, little children sat on top of him. I think we discussed it before. And, you know, it was at the similar time to that program airing, and his brother saying, oh, he's exhausted from court, and making it look like he's asleep, you know, and saying how exhausting court was. And it's just that whole show. And that's really what it is. It's, you know, Pistorius being the ringmaster and using other people to manipulate the media and to get the message out that they want to get out. And, of course, there's no sense of Reva. It just becomes wholly and entirely about them. And, you know, obviously the revelation as well that he may even compete in the 2020 Olympics.
Are you serious?
That's a possibility. I mean, if we think he's been sentenced to 6 years, he probably will. I mean, he will only serve 3 years at the very least, but he may even be out, you know, within a year or 18 months. That's the reality.
Wow.
I mean, it really is shocking.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and the message that it sends to, you know, is a very negative message that you can get away with murder and you can kill someone. And if you say that it's a mistake and all the things that played in, then, you know, this is a very clear case that shows, along with the O.J. Simpson case, you know, guilty until proven rich. And other people wouldn't have had the access. And, you know, then we're taken on this journey of he's a fallen hero, he's financially broken, he's psychologically broken. You know, all these things that Judge Masipa certainly gave credit to and put weight on. And, you know, even she said that they have to make sure that people don't believe that he intentionally killed her and that it was the court's duty to correct that, despite the fact she said he was a poor and contradictory witness. So she totally bought into, you know, he's a logical version of events and brought into the whole, you know, Pistorius show.
Mm-hmm.
And that part I feel very sad about because, you know, for other victims who are out there, and of course we've heard from many of them, haven't we? We've heard from many who have emailed us, who, when we explained what was going on within the WhatsApp messages, I've had so many people reach out to me, and many of whom I haven't had a chance to respond to. So I'm sorry about that. Things are pretty busy with our schedule. But I've heard from experts as well all across the world saying thank you so much for talking about coercive control in your podcast, because so many people do not identify it. They don't understand it. You know, these subtle, nuanced things. And that's exactly what was going on between Riva and Pistorius, particularly given that they had had it. This was a 4-month relationship. Mm-hmm. So that context is really important. And that's the way that he's behaving. So, you know, there was a rapid escalation, I believe, on that night when she had planned to meet him and she had said no more. And she had been trying to risk manage this tantrumous and entitled individual, fast cars, fast life, fast women. That's what his life was about, privilege and wealth. And this privilege and wealth plays in this case, and it sets a very dangerous precedent. Also, Lisa, I mean, you've heard Jim and I discuss some of the detail, sort of the WhatsApp messages, and I know, you know, the case isn't so well known in America. I mean, it certainly had a lot of coverage in the UK, and of course it was one of the UK's platforms, ITV, that did the interview with him. But how much of the trial or how much of the case did you actually know about before? And what was the bits that you kind of understood about it that were kind of different from maybe what Jim and I have discussed on the podcast?
Well, I certainly had heard of Oscar Pistorius because of course, being the Blade Runner. But we don't know him all that well in this country, but just as sort of like a Time magazine kind of a case, a feel-good story, right, kind of in the back of our minds. But, you know, he's certainly not a football player or a baseball player, somebody who we really knew. So because of that, I think hearing that he murdered his girlfriend, it just, my impression is it just seems so far away, you know, in a country so far away. And I don't think it really had a huge impact. Certainly not the way, you know, O.J. Simpson's murder of Nicole and other kinds of cases. But, you know, Vanity Fair covered it, and it got a certain amount of coverage, but it just wasn't the gripping kind of story. You know, it's hard to identify, you know, with them in a lot of different ways, obviously. So I just don't think it really had the same impact. Certainly our Facebook book listeners have posted that, you know, from the UK and from Australia and, you know, other parts of the world, it was much more, you know, way more followed. And people have written to me that they followed the case every single day and were just fascinated by it. They were obsessed with it, you know. But I don't think over here, if I may speak for my entire country, that we really had that same gut check, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, I guess if you follow athletics and you understand, you know, on the world stage what a hero he was because of the, you know, the Paralympics where he wins gold in the 100 metres and 200 metres, you know, and sets new world records. And then he, in 2012, you know, he's in the Olympics that were hosted in London. And he was the first, you know, disabled person to be in the able-bodied. And so, you know, he really was a national and international hero. And I always wondered how much coverage there was of him in the United States, just purely because when I mentioned the case, lots of people, you know, are blank and they don't really know the detail of what went on. Certainly, you know, he was awarded BBC Sports Personality of the Year as well in 2007. That's kind of a prestigious award in the UK. So, you know, he was certainly somebody that, you know, was very familiar to the UK and probably less so in the US, but he really is, you know, the O.J. Simpson. There are just so many parallels, not just because of their standing, but also, you know, obviously in the O.J. Simpson case, there was the Furman issues related to him and question marks about, you know, corruption and cross-contamination and racism and so on. And then the kind of the fallen hero for me in the Oscar Pistorius case was Detective Hilton Botha, who, you know, was a very good detective. But he was the only one right from the start, as I mentioned before, saying there were no signs of forced entry, totally inconsistent account given by Pistorius. And then when he waited to get the police file and the prosecution case, he matched his account in court to what was seen and heard in the police files, i.e. saying that it was his scream, not a female scream. But Bota was convinced it was murder from the start, and he had 24 years experience, and he was the first officer at the scene, and he was the one who had previously arrested Pistorius for the violent incident.
Yeah, but didn't they remove him from the case, and they
did.
Decimated his character for some previous, I can't remember what it was, but it was.
So it was a previous incident that involved an assault where individuals got away in a taxi, I believe it was, and he discharged his firearm 7 times, and it was that, it was previous years that had happened, but suddenly that investigation into him was reinvigorated and was opened up again, and therefore I think he gave evidence for one day and then he was discredited and taken off the case because of that reinvestigation. So I think that was a very interesting set of circumstances, because he was the one person really saying something different to what others were saying. And you know, I don't know how well connected the Pistorius family are, but I should imagine that their tentacles and their standing in the community is relatively high. And to me, it smacks of some pressure being put on and both are being removed. And certainly 24 years experience as a very good detective, I do trust his account and his version of what was put forward. So I think, you know, the parallels are just... they're very, very similar, these two cases, other than the fact that Pistorius actually did get, he was found guilty, but in the first trial, as we know, it was a culpable homicide, and he only really received 1 year in prison, although it was a 5-year sentence. And then due to the outrage, the public outrage, and that outrage has been, was in South Africa, but it was also on the world stage too. A lot of the violence against women and girls sector, we made our voices very well known, and that pressure came on. And then the prosecution, Jerry Nell, you know, he did a great job with what he had, and of course they appealed it and it went to the Supreme Court, and that's where we got the charge that was upgraded to murder. So it's been an interesting, and no doubt it's an interesting case, but I should imagine it's been incredibly harrowing and long for the Steenkamp family, and I have no doubt that they want to draw a line under it. You know, they trusted the criminal justice system, and I think they are they're incredible, but they must feel incredibly exhausted by all of this, and this latest outcome and sentence really does not reflect the seriousness of what has gone on here, but no doubt they are exhausted and drained and weary from fighting not just what happened, you know, and accepting what happened to their daughter, but fighting the system as well.
Yeah, there is a BBC short documentary that I did watch that they were in, and yes, they do. Exhaustion is the perfect word to use. They do look just wrung out by this whole process. So, you know,
and I believe Pistorius has been trying to contact them, and you know. Again, the judge sees that as signs of remorse, but, you know, these are the things that he has to tick the boxes on to show willing. And the Steenkamps, I believe, have not accepted that. You know, they just cannot deal with speaking to him. I think they said it was difficult enough seeing him in court every day with the histrionics, et cetera, that he was pulling. But I certainly get a sense that they are just worn out with it all, and maybe one day they will look him in the eye and hear his account. But I certainly think from what I have seen, and I saw some of the ITV interview, you know, I feel he's a very good actor and a very good liar. And he and O.J. Simpson certainly have that in common. You know, they're people who you want to believe and seem incredibly plausible. But for me, it just does not add up. There are too many inconsistencies. There are too many behavioural problems around his account of not checking to see whether it was Reva which is the first thing that you would do if you heard a noise or thought there was a threat. You would think it's the other person who is making the noise, or you would look to protect them. And just that very small thing on its own. And then we have all the other inconsistencies about...
Yeah, there's so many.
There are just too many, and his account is totally illogical. But I think he played the cards and he played the system. He manipulated many, sadly, including Judge Masipa. So why don't we just take a quick pause here to have a word from our sponsor. So thank you, and let's get back to our podcast.
Well, the good news is, Laura, that thanks to you, getting back to our listeners, our few of the listeners who have reached out to us, they have reached out to us again, and some of these women have left, and they have gotten help. So I want to thank you for giving, you know, them a platform, you know, to contact us, and for, you know, reaching out to them and giving them help, because in our small ways, I think, you know, we are helping in you know, doing what we can. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm just glad that we can talk about these issues, you know, and reach people in a different way. And, you know, for me, it's there's a story about starfish that, you know, on the beach, there's a lot of starfish that are washed up, and a little boy goes along throwing some of the starfish back into the water. And someone asked him the question about, you know, there are thousands of starfish here, and you're just throwing, you know, the ones that you can back in the water, and it really makes no difference. And he said, to the starfish that I pick up, it makes a huge difference, and it's the difference between life and death for them. And even if we save one starfish, then it's been worth it. And that's how I feel about being able to communicate things in a different way of using the media, using podcasts, as well as training law enforcement and other professionals. And, you know, I feel very privileged to do the work that I do, and certainly to hear from the victims that I do. And there's no greater honour and privilege. And certainly when I hear that somebody has lived safely and that I've played a part in that, that's the thing that makes me walk 10 foot taller. And
oh, good. Well, that's a great story. Oh, my gosh, I almost started crying when you said that starfish story. That's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Well, Laura, this has been a great discussion. I'm sorry Jim couldn't be here to wrap up the Reva Steenkamp murder with us, but
he's here in spirit. We just have a very busy schedule right now. He's certainly, yeah, just a lot going on right now, but he will certainly be back on the next podcast, which we very much look forward to.
Stay tuned. Thank you so much for your support and for all of your comments on Facebook about the Reva Steenkamp murder. We've had just a tremendous amount of questions and comments and conversations. So thank you for those. And we will be back.
Yeah, and just a thank you to everyone for all your messages and certainly emails that I've received. I will and do intend to get back to you. And, you know, it's just been a really busy time. And certainly thank you to all of those who are using our hashtag of hashtag her name was Reva or hashtag her name was Nicole. I think it's so important that we rebalance things and make sure that we remember the victims and not keep talking just solely about the perpetrators. So thank you for that.
Very well said.
So thank you, Lisa. I've really, you know, enjoyed talking with you on this podcast, and we've certainly missed Jim. But I also want to thank our listeners as well, and thank you, and thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
So if you like our show and you want to help us out, there are a couple things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and leave us a positive 5-star review. You can also like our Facebook page and join in on some great questions, comments, and conversations. We always love to hear from you there. You can follow us on Twitter. You can check out our sponsors. And most importantly, you can share us with friends, family, and anyone you know who's interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. Thanks for listening.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org, or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.
Yeah.